am joined here with Dr. Alexander Jacob. It's nice having you on the show.
It was nice being with you.
You're originally from India, and you have a PhD from Pennsylvania State University.
Yes, right.
Hello, and you have a number of books published out on Arctos Publishing.
Yes, I've actually published one book, De Natura in Natura, which was published earlier in Germany, and the others are translations of French New Rights thinkers like Alain Benoit and Pierre Corret.
So I'd like to go over some of that work. Is there anything else you'd like to say about yourself?
Well, I don't know. What would you like to know about me?
Give kind of a brief biography. You can talk about your kind of personal points of views.
I live in India, as you know, and then when I was 19, I moved to England to do my master's there. Then after that, I went to America to do my doctorate in history of ideas, which is Renaissance philosophy, actually. And then I did my postdoctoral work at the University of Toronto in Canada, and I became a Canadian citizen. And now I am in Europe teaching English.
So this is your book, the one, Atman.
Right, that's a book I published in 2005, and I published a supplement to it called Brahman this year, actually. So this is based on the ancient cosmology of the Indo-Europeans. So I reconstructed it using documents from various sources. And I also studied the rituals related to those ancient religions.
You talk a lot about, you talk about the ancient religions of Egypt, Sumer, and Akkad, and Assyria. So it's not just about India, but also about the ancient Germans. And you talk about Indo-Europeans or the word, you talk about the word Aryan. So do you mean that in a, I guess the terminology is used in a, there's the sort of the ancient Aryans, or there's sort of the more newer sort of Eurocentric definition of that word?
Right. I use Indo-European in a much broader sense than most people. Most people confine Indo-European to what might be called, what I would call Aryan. In fact, Indo-European, I think, includes other branches as well. I use the Noachidian divisions in Genesis, where Noah has three sons, Shem, that is a Semitic, and then Japhet, which is the Aryan, and Ham, which is the Hamitic. And I include all of these as belonging to the same original race. So I have a much broader view of the Indo-European family than most linguists do, because only Semitic and Japhetic, that is Aryan, are inflected languages. Hamitic is partly inflected and partly agglutinative. The linguistic forms are different, and so they don't include those. But I do not see this linguistic separation as valid, because they all share the same religion, the same gods, and so they must belong to the same race. So this is why I have such a broad view of the Indo-European family.
And you talk about the spiritual makeup of the Aryans, and you compare it to the Semitic makeup. Can you give some specific examples? I know you've discussed that a lot. And by Semitic, what is your definition of Semitic?
Oh, right. No, there is no problem with Semitic. As I said, Shem is the eldest son of Noah, and that is Semitic. So the original manifestation of the Semitic race is in Elam, which is in Iran. And the Elamites are Semites, according to the Bible. And they have the same religion. And then the Akkadians, also Eastern Semites, have the same religion as well. The Assyrians who follow are also Semites. They're all Semites, and they're all part of the same Indo-European ethos and religious view. When I complain about the Semitic viewpoint, religious viewpoint, it is only restricted to the Jewish, because the Jewish, also Semites, are different from the Akkadian or the Assyrian or something, because they revolted against the old religion and established their monotheistic religion. And this is what you might be referring to. I think you're thinking of that interview I did with David Duke many years ago. And so there is a difference, but it's not because they are Semites, but it's because they are Jews, because they have a specific religion, which is a nationalist one. It is not at all like the cosmologically oriented religions of the other Semites. I suppose that is what you're referring to.
You talk about how that came about in ancient times. How are those differences relevant in the modern world?
Oh, the modern world, they're very, very relevant because the Jewish view, worldview, if you like, which is not particularly a religious view, as a nationalistic one, is the one that is ruling at the moment. And this is the problem. The problem is that we are being ruled by people who don't have a spiritual view of the world, but only a political and nationalistic one. This is a Zionist problem, you see. And that is my critique of it. So it is not all Semites. And the Arabs are also Semites, you know, but they also have a religion that is based now on Judaism, that is Islam. Originally, they were all, also polytheistic and the Canaanites and all these people. So it is only the religions that derive from Judaism that have this peculiarity of not being so metaphysical or spiritual, but political about their own national god, as it were. And
are you talking about Judaism as a religion, or you're saying more because more is it because people who are not, you're talking about people who are not, who reject sort of the spiritual side and focus on the materialistic side? And I think that's kind of, that's is one of the main issues with the modern society.
Right. That is one of the major issues with the American society, which is ruled by Jewish interests. And so the whole direction of the global enterprise is going the wrong way. Because there's no religious quality at all to it. Secularization is compulsory. You must get rid of all the religions, whether it's Islam or Christianity or anything. And then, simply make money and prosper if you can. I think it's difficult considering the crises that are going on in Europe and elsewhere.
And so, you talk about the Aryan, we talk about the Aryans in India. What are some of the links between the Europeans and the Aryans in say, India or the Middle East?
Right. As I said, we all share the same religion originally. And so, Wotan, for instance, is just a form of Vata. Vata is an Iranian god. And we also have Vata, who is a form of Vayu, who's the god a wind god, as it were. But it's really the breath that infuses the cosmos originally. And so we have the same gods and the same forms of worship as well. Originally, all Indo-European religions were phallic-oriented, that is, worshippers, the phallus as constituting the life of the universe. We still have phallic worship in India. But but they had it in Germany as well, Scandinavia, and so on. So all of this is based on the life of the universe. So it's a sort of vitalistic religion, and it is based on the correspondence between the macrocosm and the microcosm, human microcosm. And in doing everything for God, as it were, for the cosmos, as it were, because the Brahmins or the Druids or whoever the priestly leaders were completely in tune with the cosmos and felt it necessary to sustain the cosmos and to sustain mankind through this connection, as it were. So it's really very, very elevated at a very lofty level that they operated. And so this is common to all of the religions of the Indo-Europeans, from India to Ireland, actually.
So those religions, ancient religions, were informed sort of by the creation of the cosmos.
Right, based on an understanding of the inner working of the cosmos, and particularly the creation of the sun. All of them worship the sun. In fact, the original race, or one part of it, called itself Hurrians. Hurrians is a form of Surian. Surya is the word for sun in Sanskrit. And so that is the original description of the race, I think. Not Aryan or Hamitic or Semitic or anything, but Hurrian, which is Surian, or sun worshippers. So it is based on a cosmos which begins with Atman, which is the supreme soul, and then through desire he manifests himself as a cosmic man, and then with his life, his balance, if you like, he creates the universe and ultimately emerges the sun. It sustains us. So it is a completely vitalistic sort of religion. So the sun, as I said, is the closest to a deity in our universe, because the universe is much larger than our solar system.
So there's also an organic correspondence between the macrocosm and the human microcosm that emerges in sort of the course of the study. You talk about the esoteric philosophy of the Indians.
All right, that's the Upanishads. The Upanishads are a commentary on the Vedas. The Vedas are the scriptures which are used during the sacrifices, the liturgy, as it were, the chants that are sung by the priests and so on. And these are very very arcane, very mysterious, because the Brahmins are really like magicians, because they can effect these miraculous transformations through symbolic sacrifices, and throwing fire. Fire, of course, is related to the sun. It is the closest that we have to the sun on Earth. And so this doctrine is reserved for the Brahmins, and the Upanishads are the commentaries on them, and they're also reserved only for the Brahmins and so on. So it's esoteric in the sense that only a few can ever hope to learn all the mysteries of the cosmos. And so it is reserved for them, and so it's esoteric. Later on, it becomes exoteric when the Hamitic people set up their culture, that is in Sumer and Egypt. Then you have temples. The original Aryans from Central Asia, the Black Sea area and so on, did not have any temples at all. They had only these symbolic sacrifices using fire. But then when the Sumerians and Egyptians developed their culture, they used these external forms, more exoteric, with representations of deities and idols and so on and so forth. And, of course, even there, only the pharaoh or the priest could conduct the services. But they were open to the public. The common people could also, participate in it. more freely. So that is already a sort of degeneration from the Aryan point of view. Even in India, the Aryan priest, the Brahmin priest, originally opposed the temple priests, who they thought were too exoteric. So that is the development in these religions.
You focus mainly on the spiritual aspects. Is there? Would you say there's a strong genetic link between the Aryans of the India and the Middle East with those of Europe?
Right, the upper castes of India are all closely related to either the Mediterranean or the Armenian or other branches of the European race also. So they share, I think, the same genes. I'm not an expert in DNA and that sort of thing, but right, there are links, clearly. Apart from that, the languages are also related. Sanskrit, for instance, is so similar to all the Slavic languages that are still spoken in Eastern Europe, from Russia to the Czech Republic, where I am. And when I listen to them speak, it sounds just like Sanskrit. It sounds more Sanskritic than Hindi, which is our modern Indian language, because our language has a lot of Islamic, Arabic influences, because we were ruled by the Arabs and Muslims for hundreds of years. So actually, the whole of Eastern Europe is Sanskritic. So, you know, it's clear that all belong to the same tradition.
So do you write about the contrast in India between the Aryans and the Dravidians?
The Dravidians are like the Hamitic. They are the ones who excelled in temple building and this and that. So if you go to South India, where I am from, you will see all these wonderful temples and so on, just like in Egypt or somewhere, not much is left, but Egypt, with temple tanks and so on, exactly like in the Middle East. So, right, but they're all part of the same family because they have the same tradition. Only they speak an agglutinative language. I told you about the differences in languages. And the people of North India speak inflected languages. So I do not think it's a problem, but it's artificially created by linguists as if the two belong to two different races or something. In fact, it's all the same.
But do you personally, you identify more with the Aryans or the Dravidians in India?
Well, I mean, we're all mixed so much in India, so we have both elements. But I suppose because my parents are from South India, I would be more Dravidian than Aryan. But it's all Indo-European, that is certain. And the Dravidians, by the way, I believe, are really related to the Druids because the name is so similar, Druid and Drawid, is almost the same name. And there are so many other similarities in the writing system and so on and so forth. So the Dravidians are really very, very ancient. They probably the original Indo-Europeans, as it were.
So when did the invasion of the Aryans into India, when did that take place?
Oh, the Aryans were in India before the Dravidians. First, the Aryans came from Central Asia or something, and then from Mesopotamia came the Dravidians. And Megasthenes, who was a Greek writer of ancient times, wrote that the Indians, meaning the Aryan Indians, were nomadic and didn't have temples or anything until Dionysus. Dionysus is the term for a god that we worship in South India called Muruga. And he has the same qualities. And so on, until he came to India and, built cities and these temple cultures and so on. So, right, the Aryans were in India before. And then the two mixed to form modern Hinduism, if you like.
So you're saying, did Hinduism come more from the Aryans?
Right. Indian Indo-European religion is originally Aryan and then Dravidian. Now it is almost fully Dravidian because we only have temples and so on. Very few people conduct these sacrifices. Only a few people are so orthodox as to conduct these sacrifices. These sacrifices are very, very elaborate, and you need a lot of priests, a lot of knowledge to conduct these sacrifices, and a lot of interest in them. So they're not conducted so often. Daily sacrifices householders do, but those are very simple forms. More elaborate ones, only very few people conduct. And again, South India, because it was protected from Muslim invasions, more than North has more of these expert priests in the North.
Do you consider that all three Abrahamic faiths, you consider Judaism, Islam, and Christianity, all three of them to be Semitic?
They're definitely Semitic. But again, as I said, Semitic is such a comprehensive word. It includes a lot of these Indo-European polytheistic religions, as well as this monotheistic thing that began with Abraham. So I think you should simply call them Abrahamic religions. Right. So these three are definitely Abrahamic. But only Judaism and Islam are typically Abrahamic religions in the sense that they are very, very monotheistic. Christianity, having moved into Europe, adopts all of the polytheistic qualities of the old European Indo-European religions. So you have, Mary being worshipped and saints and all of that. All of this is not possible in Judaism or Islam. There is an exclusive focus on Allah or Yahweh and nothing else. There is no son of God or anything, or mother of God, or any holy personages in between.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard a lot of Jews, actually, they don't even consider Christianity to be a monotheistic religion.
It is not. It has a lot of the qualities of the older Indo-European religions. And it has that solar quality, which I said is typical of Indo-European religion, in that Christ is like, the sun. In fact, you find representations of Christ as Christ Apollo in early Christianity. Somewhere in the Vatican, you'll find some sculptures in the basement or something. So that is how it developed. It adopted all of the qualities of European religion. And that is why his birth is, the summer, winter solstice, and his resurrection is Easter, and it's spring and that sort of thing. It becomes a kind of cosmological religion.
You have a book, Europa. Is this a translation, or did you write this?
This is a collection of excerpts from various books by German conservative German thinkers on foreign policy, German foreign policy. So I started with Constantin Frantz and Paul de Lagarde, and Edgar Julius Jung and Alfred Rosenberg, to show that National Socialist foreign policy is not unique. It started already in the 19th century, their views of consolidating Europe under German rule and so on. And the exclusion of the Jews is also part of this program. So it is not new. It is at least 100 years old before National Socialism.
So you write about the conservatives and the National Socialists. Were there a lot of similarities, or was there conflict between the two factions?
A lot of similarities. The conservatives of the Weimar Republic, Edgar Julius Jung was one of them, were very aristocratic and monarchical as well. They harked back to the Middle Ages and clung to the Prussian Reich and so on. So they believed that Germany should rule, of course, but should rule as an aristocracy, as a monarchy, and they would not tolerate any form of socialism. National socialism was vulgar to them. So apart from that, they both of them wanted the rule of Germans because the Germans were best suited to rule. So they have a lot of things in common, but they differed. Edgar Julius Jung, for instance, served as an advisor to Papen, who was the chancellor, and he secretly plotted to assassinate Hitler, and when Hitler found out, he assassinated Jung in turn during the Night of the Long Knives. So there was opposition, but a basic similarity in that all of them had Germany at heart. That is the certainty that Germany was most suited.
So you say there was sort of an opposition to financial rule.
Financial rule, certainly. Yeah. All of them are opposed to that. And that, of course, they equated with the rule of the Rothschilds and the banks and all the Jewish interests scattered through Europe. So this they fought already from the 19th century. It only culminated in National Socialism, but it began a lot earlier. This is the reason, of course, for the anti-Semitism of the Reich.
So you're saying so it went further back than that to the 19th century?
Right, from the middle of the 19th century on, there was an opposition to this. So all the conservatives, all the socialists were opposed to this internationalism, which is, and of course, they wanted a strong Europe, and there was little possibility of that when you have international forces working against it.
And that is the root of a lot of the problems in today's world, sort of the rule of the financial plutocracy. But it is interesting how in today, I mean, people, the so-called, like the phony conservatives, will say that opposition to financial elite is like, they'll dismiss it as like leftism, which is totally absurd.
No, both right and left. It is simply a question of names. The essential conflict remains, no matter whether you call it right or left or center. The conflict is who should rule, aristocrats or bankers, that's all.
So you think it's one or the other? A lot of people sort of want a society where there's no ruling class, but whatever system you have, whether it's the communism, aristocracy, or capitalism, there always is going to be some kind of a ruling class. It seems that way. And so you're saying that was the big sort of battle is who was going to rule the aristocracy or the financial elite. But I've always heard that the aristocracy, they've always sort of in the Middle Ages and later than that, they had sort of a good relationship with a lot of the Jewish bankers, and if you look at a lot of the anti-Jewish movements, they in Europe, they did sort of start off as sort of populist movements among the peasants.
Right. Well, that's certainly true. They depended on Jewish finance because Jews had a lot of money, and we know about the Rothschilds, how the original Rothschild helped the Prince of Hesse, and because he wasted all his money and needed his help, and so he rose to great heights through this aristocratic patronage. So this has always been the case because the aristocrats could fight, but they could not save money, and so they got help from the Jews, and that is how it has been going for hundreds of years. But the problem is with the emancipation of the Jews. This is a crucial moment in the history of Europe, which came about in the middle of the 19th century also. So the Jews became more and more independent because they no longer needed the princes for political power. They could run for office, and in fact they created new parties everywhere, and slowly parties that were anti-monarchical as well. And finally we know that all the monarchies were destroyed also in a couple of wars. So once that happened, there's no longer a question of cooperation. There's only a subordination. As in England, now you have a royal family. But what power does it have? Absolutely nothing. The Rothschilds have all the power there, or whoever the other bankers might be. And the parliamentarians whom they select. So there's been cooperation, but no longer. Now it is domination.
Do you think all societies naturally have a ruling class? Do you think there ever can be a society that does not have a ruling class? Do you think it's inevitable?
What you mean?
Do you think it's inevitable that all societies have some kind of a ruling class, whether it's the aristocracy or the bankers?
No, every society must have rulers, or else it will not run. It will be anarchy, and anarchy is not a society. It is the opposite of it. So there will be rulers, but who rules is important. And it's important that a society be ruled by its own men, by its own people, people who have lived in that country for, you know, ages, have followed their traditions and so on, rather than people who move from country to country as chief executive officers and, you know, chairman, banks, and that sort of thing. These are not attached to any country at all. They are some kind of global moving elite. There's no national society possible in the present condition, and this is the problem. As for a global society, it's a monstrosity, given the diversity of the world and the differences, even economic differences between different parts. I mean, I cannot imagine anything like a global society. So the only possibility is a national society, and that cannot be ruled by international elites.
What is your personal view on issues having to do with nationalism? Because, I mean, you did, you immigrated from India to the West. So how do you sort of take your personal experience, and how does that sort of shape your views on nationalism?
My view is nationalism. I'm nationalist naturally. So, you know, India is for Indians, England is for the English, and Germany is for Germans. So, I don't know, it's just a natural position. You don't have to know very much to come to that understanding. It seems so natural.
It's made into something, kind of a pathological thing. And I think it's because a lot of it has to, the roots of it are kind of the financial elites, because they view nationalism as a threat to their power.
Right, I know. So there's this propaganda against it. And immediately the bogeyman of Hitler and national socialism and this and that, and then everyone's afraid, and then they stop their efforts. This is why all these nationalist movements in America and Europe are, you know, so ineffective, because very quickly they're put out, because they're associated with some terrible things that happened in the past. And so they're all criminalized and so on. But they really should not be afraid, because it is the most natural thing to be nationalist. It's unnatural to be internationalist.
You have another book out. Is this a translation, or this is you're based on your work, Nobilitas?
No, this is my own book on aristocratic philosophy. It's a study of aristocratic philosophy from Greek antiquity to the early 20th century. So that's a study that I did a long time ago.
So it goes. It's the book starts with ancient Greece.
And then go to the Renaissance, and then the period after that, after the Revolution in the 19th century, especially German idealism. Of course, idealism is the philosophy that you need for aristocratic societies. With any kind of materialism, is a doom. So my other book, De Natura, is also about idealistic natural philosophy. So idealistic philosophy is the only proper philosophy for an aristocratic society, because it starts with spirit rather than matter, and spirit is so far elevated above matter. And the fullest expression of spirit is God. So it starts with God and the representative of God, who is the king, and so on. So it starts from top to bottom in that way. Whereas all these materialistic, historical, materialistic, Marxist systems start with the people, you know, the proletariat and this and that. With that, you cannot go very far. You certainly not go up. You go down very quickly, as America has done. America is, by the way, a Marxist country in the sense that it has the dictatorship of the proletariat completely perfected. Especially after the 60s revolution, the hippies revolution. And so.
A lot of people say that the democratic ideas have their roots in the philosophies of Plato and Aristotle, but you disagree with that.
What? All democracy is based on Plato and Aristotle? No, it's not. I don't know who says that. They do not argue for democracy at all. They're all monarchies because that is the system they had. I mean, they had some democracy, but it was a completely different enterprise than the present. And anyway, Plato does not favor democracy. He is a monarchist. And so.
What people say is they say that, like, Greece was, especially Athens, was the first democracy.
Well, in the sense of you know, there was some participation of the people, but the people were all very different from the people of modern democracies. They were in small city-states. They had some share. For instance, Rome called itself a republic, but we know that all the senators came from the best families, only from Rome, not from southern Italy or any other part of Italy but Rome. They had to be Roman, they had to be the oldest families, and this is what they prided themselves on as a republic. So their idea of a republic is very different from the American republic. It's all very aristocratic. And then generals ruled, like Julius Caesar and so on. Right?
So you were getting into saying that the United States today is Marxist. I mean, most people would say, aren't we becoming more of a, well, in a lot of ways, we're becoming more of a plutocracy, but can you, I guess, explain in more details why you say that the United States today is Marxist?
Well, its social culture is completely Marxist. You know, cultural Marxism is a part of Marxism, and that has been consummated in America. You have, you know, the lowest forms of popular music and so on. Achieving the greatest success, all these pop idols and so on, and then all of this being exported vigorously around the world. And there's no more classical music, for instance. You never had much of it in the first place, but not even in Europe does it exist anymore, because America rules Europe as well. So in that sense, you know, it's all very, very proletarian. Russian communism, by the way, actually preserved its classical heritage better than America could do, because the Bolshoi Theater and so on were the centers of great Tsarist culture, classical culture, and that they continued to maintain. Whereas in America, there's none of that. You have, you know, some opera houses for money making, but nothing original will come from any of those houses. And your whole educational system is populist, is popular, and little children are taught to be popular. And so it will only be proletarian forever. So that is one thing. And as for oligarchy, well, oligarchy and democracy are very closely related, because it's never possible that all of the people will rule at the same time. I mean, how do they do that? So some people will take it upon themselves to rule and get all the money, and that's why you have oligarchy in America, maybe Russia.
Yeah, because that's how the cultural Marxism came about, because what happened is the economic Marxism failed in the more wealthier countries. So the premise of cultural Marxism is sort of breaking down institutions like family, nationality, ethnicity. But I think we have kind of a weird combination between cultural Marxism, but not economic. Economic Marxism has sort of failed in this country. But I mean, you're absolutely right. Cultural Marxism succeeded where economic Marxism failed.
Right. I don't know what economic Marxism is, that everybody has the same amount of money. It's a kind of dream, utopian thing. In Russian communism also, only the Communist Party members had all the power in the world. So it's no different in America. Only, you know, some people have all of the power and privileges. So I don't know what economic Marxism is. He says the working class will ultimately achieve, you know, the greatest success, have control of all the wealth of the land and so on. Maybe he's right in that sense. America has only a working class elite. You know, all the people who have the money are still proletarian.
Yeah, the thing is that egalitarian philosophies almost always fail because, I mean, humans naturally develop hierarchies. You were pointing that out even in the communism, there was a ruling class. But what is important is, I mean, egalitarianism never works, but there does have to be accountability to those in power and to those who are the elite. And that's you're saying in the West and especially in the United States, there in a sense you point out there's kind of an alien elite.
Well, it's not just alien; it is a financial elite, and you know there will be inequalities everywhere. There's never going to be a totally equal society, in spite of Marx. And the problem is when it's an economic elite. All of the aristocratic elites that I was talking about earlier in the Indo-European societies are spiritual elites. In India, for instance, the highest caste is the Brahminical, and the Brahminical are not extremely wealthy, but they're extremely wise. Again, the church was very important in European society. So these are the natural elites of an aristocratic society. When you have a financial elite and inequality resulting therefrom, then you have a horror because these people are just proletarians raised to high offices. And so you have no culture and a lot of unhappiness because of inequalities, economic inequalities as well.
It's interesting you bring up the Brahmins because a lot of people consider the caste system in India to be a horribly unjust system. But you personally consider the United States that we have to be a lot worse than the Indian caste system.
Well, there's no comparison at all. I mean, ours is a spiritual caste system, and this is an economic class system. So you can't compare the two at all. The British had a class system, but again, they had an aristocracy, so it is so different when you compare the economic differences that existed once in England with the economic differences that exist now in America between the rich and the poor. The rich are no better than the poor in any way in America. They just have more money, whereas in England, the rich had culture, you know, as well, and that is a vital difference to me. So whether it's class or caste system, it all depends on who's at the top.
So that's sort of the reasoning for why you see that. I mean, modern day American culture, for the most part, a lot of it is garbage.
Right, and it is garbage right to the highest levels. All of the people in the highest offices are part of the same culture. They have no higher one. This is a great lack, a great defect in your society. So this is the horror of modernism. You know? They broke all the barriers down and made it free for the proletariat to rise.
And also, because of globalization, that the whole world, I mean, people talk about multiculturalism, but it's kind of a lie, because the whole world is sort of becoming more kind of monocultural, because I mean,
right.
People watch the same television and movies.
Right. It's all American, and there is no such thing as multiculturalism. Multiculture is monocultural. I mean, once it forms into a culture, it is one culture. The problem with multiculturalism is that nowadays it is mostly an American multiculturalism, or American culture. And American culture is basically Jewish and Negro. All of your music and dance and so on is Negroid, but adapted by Jewish experts who have, you know, more training and so on. So jazz and all of that, you know, is basically a kind of African culture. And why the rest of the world should adopt this, I cannot for a moment perceive. I mean, this is a horrible world, I think. Right, so it is monoculture. There is no such thing as multiculturalism. There are different strands informing a culture, and the different strands informing the major culture of the world today are these two. It's Jewish Negro. There's very little Anglo-Saxon culture left, or if ever there was, in your culture, or anything else. Right? I don't see it.
Do you see it mainly as just sort of a trend, or what do you think about the people who talk about like the conspiracy theory type stuff? Do you see some of that, or do you think it's just sort of a trend?
A conspiracy to produce this kind of culture? No,
well, conspiracy is something. The idea of a conspiracy theory is something that is planned out and orchestrated,
right,
kind of in secret, as opposed to something that just kind of evolves on its own.
Well, all revolutions are organized. So you might say that the 60s revolutions were also organized. And to that extent, I suppose there's some conspiracy. But there may be. I don't know who's behind it, Masons or whoever. But certainly the result is clear that, you know, you have now this kind of subculture, and it makes it easy for the financial interests, I suppose, to prosper therewith, and so they propagate it strenuously. Cultural conspiracy, yeah, I mean, actually, you know, during the war and after, the CIA was involved in propagating modern music in Europe and so on, so that, you know, no nationalistic forms would arise. And in fact, they've succeeded, I think. Nothing has arisen since the war in Europe. So it might be a conspiracy. It might be CIA. It might be so many agencies. Sorry?
We're out of time. Before I wrap it up, I want to comment on something briefly, because the issue of about most of the people who are anti-American and the other parts of the world, they come about it from kind of a leftist point of view. But that actually is a good argument to make, like what you said about the CIA promoting that culture in Europe for, I mean, Europeans to be anti-American. It's just a lot of some people are anti-American from sort of the wrong reasons. But you make an excellent point there.
Right. I hope people will get a different perspective on things because the situation is really quite complex, and one must have a very clear vision to know what is what. So, well, it was very interesting speaking to you. Do you have any other questions?
Just do you have a website for the audience?
Sorry?
Do you have a website?
No, I don't.
Your information is up on, if in case the audience is interested, it's up on Arctos Publishing, arctos.com.
Right.
I'd like I'd like to thank Dr. Alexander Jacob for being on.
And thank you very much for inviting me to this program.
That's all we have for tonight, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.